Hey, this is Future Thinkers, where we talk about how to adapt to a changing world, build more resilience, upgrade culture and society, and create meaning and purpose. With your hosts, Mike Gilliland and Yuvi Ivanova.
I just want to do a little intro, like an official start. Hi, everyone. For those of you who don't know Nora Bateson, she is the founder of the International Bateson Institute and the author of Small Arcs of Larger Circles, which came out in 2016. And she's currently working on a new book about warm data. And Joe Brewer is the author of The Design Pathway for Regenerating Earth and the founder of the Earth Regenerator Study Group, which is quite lively. Go check it out if you haven't yet. And today we're going to have a Q&A and conversation about earth regeneration and smart villages or eco-villages, new ways of living that have kind of been brewing in the background for a lot of us for a long time and are coming forth quite a lot this year, thanks to COVID. So yeah, why don't we get started? And if anyone has questions, you can drop them in the chat and then we'll either read them out or unmute you and you can read it out. And why don't we get started with a question which you guys have already started talking about. What has changed and what is still changing? What is emerging for both of you right now?
Yeah, Nora, would you like to go first?
Go ahead.
Okay, I will share that what's emerging for me is the capacity to manifest a dream articulated by people like Dana Meadows back in the early 80s. And what's happening in the early 1980s and now is the effect of global economy has undermined and destroyed most of those efforts or kept them at very small scales. So they couldn't scale upward. And now the larger scale systems are becoming so fragile and breaking down as the system continues collapsing that it's opening up this possibility for organizing in this different way at fairly large scales. And so for me personally, I'm able to participate in coordinating projects across the territory of about 400,000 hectares of land where we have a strong local capacity to build a living systems economy. And so I feel the ability to actually envision this and do it is emerging, whereas people have articulated the need for it for half a century. But it's been very, very difficult to achieve. And I feel that very present with all of the continuing threats of the exponential patterns of the global system.
Wonderful. What about you, Nora?
What's emerging? I think what's emerging for me is, I'm just going to kind of invite you into my sort of current thoughtscape. Because I did hear Joe say something about we're doing stuff and the larger systems are breaking down and then the smaller system broke down and I was out of that conversation. But yeah, I think that's what's really interesting for me right now is actually paying attention to the ways in which there are so many different contexts of rapid change taking place. And how I am beginning to perceive the way those come together, but also watching how others are as well. I've been working in a lot of different communities since the moment the pandemic opened up, and I was working with some of those communities before. And what has kind of begun to surface is that there's a very kind of almost indescribable sort of confusion. And it's interesting because it's being held in a kind of determined continuing of patterns. I'm still who I was. I'm still who I was. I can still do what I did. I still am who I was. And so I think between the ecological issues. Certainly, I have a lot of close friends and family, a couple of them in this call that are in California and that have been in the fires out there. And then, of course, there's the elections, say no more. And then there's all kinds of very dramatic economic changes of that are kind of mind-boggling of, you know, what happens if some percentage of people can't pay their rent? What happens then? Where, you know, and then there's the family movement of the children being on Zoom, and there's these families that are suddenly spending time together for better and for worse, and children on the screens too much, and there's a lot happening all at once. And also at the beginning of the pandemic, my ex-husband got corona and got really very sick and was actually intubated and put into an induced coma for a couple of weeks. So we didn't know if he was going to live. So I never had this moment of being able to think about the coronavirus as being something out there. It was pretty much from the start, it was in my face. And having to think about how to address the very real possibility that he could have died. Everybody else in his ward but him did die. And my, you know, my kids were thinking about how to lose their father, and how, you know, my daughter's in California and I'm in Sweden and we couldn't get to him, and no one could get to anyone. And so I think and in the meantime, I started a beautiful garden, got some chickens, and started to live on the land in a way that I had wanted to for a long time. So I guess what I'm really thinking about right now is how to be in all these relationships with ourselves, with each other, with our families, with the land, and while all of them are changing. And so I think this to me is, this is the question that I'm working with right now.
We should take a stab at that question too. Mm-hmm. Lots going on.
Mm-hmm.
That's what we're thinking about.
Sure, go ahead.
We moved back to Canada mid-pandemic, March, with a 10-month, or no, he was 5 months old at the time.
4 months, I think.
Something like that. Kind of announced the Smart Village project, and the momentum from that really exploded all at once. And
yeah, it felt like, you know, we'd been talking about this, planning and thinking about it for 10 years, and suddenly it was in the right time and the right place.
Yeah. And, you know, big part due to COVID, more people are thinking about this. The amount of people that have actually contacted us saying, I already have a tiny home, I just want to park it at your property is significant.
Or RV, like, everybody got a tiny home or RV this year.
Yeah. And then at the same time, it feels like the demand on us is, and everybody, but I can only really speak for myself, the demand is a lot more focused, and our focus is a lot more narrowed. There's a lot more demanded of us, and yet everything seems vital and important. And there's not a lot of time kind of left to waste on anything. And at the same time, we're forced indoors, and, you know, we're closer to family now than we've ever been. It's such a strange disruption. It has so many good things about it, at the family level.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it seems like, I keep thinking about this idea that evolutionary pressure is what makes things emerge, what makes things change. It's not change makers or, you know, corporations or even people or influencers that make things change. It's evolutionary pressure, which is such a complex set of forces that, you know, nobody can really predict it or even parse it where exactly it's coming from. You know, COVID is just one factor, but there are a million other factors. But I'm just feeling it so much this year that there's so much evolutionary pressure coming from a lot of different sides. And I'm seeing it around us in the world, and I'm seeing it in us. Mm-hmm. In what you're saying, you know, there's so much demanded of us and so much responsibility. But it feels like it's all in the right direction. You know, it's not kind of this being in a hamster wheel kind of pressure.
Yeah. Yeah, there's movement.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Would you like to get into some questions? People are starting to put them in the chat. Claire has a question.
I thought you would get into the discussion a bit more, but it's more at a bioregional level. Wondering if you've seen ways, it just seems to me that there isn't a lot of, at a municipal planning level or at a regional level, infrastructure to support the networking, like building the quality of networks in relationships at the grassroots level. So, I know having done research long ago, animators and facilitators, but it just doesn't, I would love to hear about models, if you know of any, of what we can be asking for, because not a lot of thoughts put there. It doesn't seem.
I have some thoughts on that, Claire. Some of it from the work that I did with the Regenerative Communities Network last year, where we saw examples of people attempting to build this infrastructure. So I'll just mention that as my answer for now. And that is that mostly it was because there was one person or one small team that were really dedicated network weavers. People who are going and mapping social networks and organizations, hosting and convening events, having those convening events reveal discourse and dialogue that maps the available capacities and then directs them toward integration. And I'll give an example. In the Hudson Valley area, there's one young man who happened to go around and talk to all of the people doing organic and regenerative farming, and to the farmers markets and the local stores that sell produce, and just started talking to them and assessed their level of integration. And then from that began to see gaps and started hosting events. And so it's often one person or a small group of people. So from an infrastructure point of view, most of the best examples I've seen are very light on infrastructure, and they're very agile and dynamic as evolving social networks of interaction. There are some other examples, like what you might see with the city of Rotterdam and Kate Raworth, where they're actually using municipal governments and regional planning to attempt things. But I actually see that being more talk and less impact. And the more impactful ones, so far at least, are these more informal emergent social networks. What's beautiful about them is they're largely invisible, even as they function. And so so just that Hudson Valley example, you might live in the Hudson Valley and not know this network exists because it's mostly in the mind of one person. Mm-hmm. Not like the entire network's in their mind, but their mind is holding a sense-making capacity. And they are doing, you know, data mapping, surveys, and other things outside of their brains. But it's actually mostly their social dialogue as a dynamic. And that's where I've seen some of the best work. But maybe just another example that is slightly different is what Common Land Foundation is doing, where they come in to say the Altiplano of Spain, that's a million hectares, and start convening farmers who want to convert from traditional to regenerative farming, and then start to map their supply chains to help them shift what they produce and bring it to market. Where there, they're actually doing economic development at a regional scale, but built from the interest of the producers, which is a similarly structured dynamic process, but is a little more visible. So those are two examples that I think start to give you an archetypal sense of what is functioning well, which is mostly about convening and organizing motivated people and then helping them to see themselves as a system and helping that system to continue emerging. And it's mostly not regional planning offices in municipal governments because they're so entrenched in the dominant systems that they're pretty dysfunctional. Occasional exceptions, but generally speaking, they're not doing the job.
So this is the work that that we are doing with the warm data, pretty much on point. The way that we are doing it resonates with quite a bit with what you're saying, Joe, and it has to do with essentially getting parallel. It's very difficult to create that infrastructure from within the existing system. It pretty much has to be adjacent, at least. And so with the warm data work, what happens there that's really interesting is that that there's a real shift in the way that the people in the community begin to not only perceive each other and their lives together, but also to begin to have language and experience and multi-contextual conversations about that. So this allows for a really significant it's a really significant perception shift that pretty much changes all the action. So one of the things that you can do is you can have an idea or a model that you think, okay, this is what we got to implement. But then you know the community doesn't want to do that. And if you get, you know, somebody who's got this idea, we're going to implement this thing, that is like a really quick way to polarize a community and to create even more fragmentation at a time when what's really needed is to actually be nourishing relationships that are able to go beyond the existing scripts and beyond the existing polarities. There are many communities right now are dealing with serious polarities, whether they're at the racial level or economic level, or they're immigrants, or they're dealing with gender issues, or it's criminal, or there's all sorts of stuff right now. A million ways to be divided. And social media and, of course, technology is exaggerating that division. So I think in my sort of, in order just to add to what Joe's saying, I think that probably one of the most important things that has to happen at that municipal community level is that there be a kind of mutual learning around what's happening. Who are you? Getting to some of those sort of things that I was just talking about a minute ago. How are we in relationship? What do we mean? What would a healthy economy be like? And so this process is an invitation to make more flexible those ideas, which for a very long time the culture has concretized as separated, siloed, that there are particular ways. I mean, for example, that there are particular ways of making change. And even that idea, what you don't see in it is that it's an ecological error, right? And if we're going to be doing ecological work and starting to live in ecological ways, the thinking needs to be ecological too. So what does it look like to even ask that question differently together? Because if you don't, you're going to get all kinds of, weird old patterns trying to produce new lifestyles. And they sneak in, patterns of competition, patterns of separating, patterns of thinking. We need to create an education system and thinking that that's somehow different than health or gardening or what are the ways in which we're going to be parents of the next generation? What are we going to learn from the stories that our children are asking for right now? So there's a depth here that I want to be really careful that we don't brush over. Because it's easy to come in and say, well, what you need is, you know, 40 people on the side with this much money and this much of a program, and it should have this kind of outcome, and you need to be really clear on these potential steps to get through it. Because if you do that, your whole approach is going to lack the sensitivity to the complexity where all the possibility lies. So that's why we're doing the warm data stuff, for exactly that reason. So I hope that makes sense, just to kind of add to what Joe said.
Should I keep going, Mike and Yuvi, and build on this, or should we go to another question? How would you like to facilitate? Or do you want us to just have a flowing dialogue?
Let's just flow.
Yeah, I think this is a really good starting point.
Excellent. Then I wanted to build on something Nora was just saying with a really powerful process that's happening here in Bodhichara because of my friend Felipe. And Felipe is 30 years old, so he's fairly young, and has about 6 or 7 years of experience working on transformation of conflict in war zones in Colombia. And one of the things that he's done is he's connected that with the study of deep ecology. And now that's the way he and his wife are raising their children. So we're raising our children with their children, and it's beautiful. And what's starting to happen, to show how conflict transformation is an example of what Nora is talking about, we have a conflict that emerged here in Bodhichara about 10 years ago, where there's a green belt, this basic, like a river drainage that goes through the town, that has started to become a network of forest reserves. And there's a landowner who doesn't live here who wanted to build 20 houses, like apartments, which would destroy part of this green belt. And for 10 years, the way to stop it was to stand in front of the bulldozers, was basically to create an antagonism to it. And what Felipe started to do just 2 months ago is start a dialogue of transformation, which is to deeply listen to what everyone of the stakeholders has to say, try to understand their core needs, and facilitate a dialogue that can create new imagination. And in the span of less than 2 months, the current owner now is inclined to build less than 4 buildings, and all of them being ecological designs of small cabins, and to use the property as a forest reserve in a network of 5 other forest reserves that were not connected until the dialogue started. And they felt that these existing projects that weren't connected, if they became a network, it would influence the imagination of this piece of land. And in the span, you know, from 10 years of resistance and no movement on either side, they were basically stopping destruction, but creating nothing beautiful. Here in the span of 2 months, a network of 5 forest reserves was created with this piece of property, soon to become the 6th. And so this comes out of the ability to sense into the deep context of the people, you know, the warm data, as Nora is saying. And in that space, to recognize that the nightmares people are living in are very narrow, and the space of possibility is much bigger. Mm-hmm. And the space of possibility grows out of dreaming together, of dreaming of what the best possible things are that everyone feels good about. And it turns out Felipe is very good at facilitating this kind of dialogue. It's a beautiful thing to watch. And now we're bringing that to other pieces of land that are in conflict, and transforming. What's basically happening is the rape and pillage of the land is actually the traumas and the nightmares of the humans. And if the humans can dream into something beautiful for the land, then the land is saved by the dreams of the human, with quotes on saved there, because it's really the human's ability to imagine and to dream is what's missing. And so this is something very powerful, and I'm witnessing it up close. And so just it deeply validates what Nora is saying.
Yeah, I'm seeing it in urban situations as well. And that in the urban situation, it looks like it's a tricky one, right? Because I can get invited into communities that are in trouble to try to help them get through something, and to do something systemic, right? People want to do, we want to use complexity. We want to deal with this with complexity. But they already have an idea of what that means. And what that means is that they're going to come in and they're going to actually improve the various sort of channels, if you want to call them stakeholder positions, or sectors, right? So they're going to come in, they're going to improve the education system, they're going to improve the health system, they're going to improve the employment, improve housing, improve. Now, this is urban world that I'm talking about now. So this is another kind of ecology. But what's interesting is that there's a necessary pre-shift, okay? Before that can happen, there needs to be some kind of mutual learning process. Otherwise, you get this really interesting situation, which is that, first of all, you know, you get the experts coming in there telling them how to fix stuff. We all know where that goes. Or there's another thing that happens where you might come in and have like a town hall meeting sort of a thing and ask people, you know, what do you need and what's going on, and think that you're opening up the communication and you're really going to find out what's happening in the town. But there's a really interesting inverse effect there that I think it's important to pay attention to, which is that the problem is that we've been living in these societies that have these ideas. And what is impossible to know is how deeply they've grown inside of us. And so if you ask a community of people in a town hall what they want, what they need, they know what kind of things they can need. And those kind of things that they can need are the same kind of things that are available on the grant proposals. They are the kind of things that look like very siloed improvements. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so then what you get is actually, you get it, the communication gets all convoluted, and where you go from there is really tricky. So there's a necessary kind of pre-step of working with the community into a process. This is where we are doing the warm data work to until they're seeing the interdependency they have with each other and that they're living within. And the most fascinating thing happens in that moment is that they stop saying what things they want, and they start to describe what kind of relationships they want to support. And that is that's an ecological shift. And so when you get that, then you have another set of possible programs and projects and inputs that are of a very different order. And frankly, they aren't really going to be very identifiable by the existing municipalities and funding boards. So back to that parallel question, you got to get parallel to the existing system to do the work that needs to get done.
Yeah, and related to that is something that I think is really powerful to hold in mind, and that is what happens when there is a perception that a commons exists, or the perception that no commons exists, where it may not be consciously called a commons, but the absence of a commons is what's felt. Because I found this with the way of thinking about a gift economy, where I see people bring transactional scarcity to the gift economy because they're actually not experiencing a commons. And if they're experiencing a commons, their needs are being met, so they don't feel the scarcity and they act in a more altruistic and generous way. And so the felt experience of the relationship is different. And one way that we're exploring that with the ecological part of regeneration is by looking at the movement of water across landscapes. And then what we start to see is things like we have a so-called water scarcity problem. It turns out, no, we have a water escape problem because where I'm living, they cut down the forest 40 years ago. All the topsoils are gone. And when it rains, it just forms big floods of mud that take the remaining soil or dirt, because it's actually not soil, and drop it in the river down below. And so what happens is people experience there not being enough water, when what they actually are experiencing, what's actually happening, is the inability to retain and cycle water through the system. And so there's this really important shift between the perception of problem as a felt experience through the disconnection of something like the faucet in your kitchen. And then as I can walk right out my door here and like 10 meters, when it rains hard, this is cobblestone streets in this town. There's a river of water every time it rains hard. And in 20 minutes, we have enough water run down that street to serve this town for 6 months. 6 months in 10 minutes. But we're not cycling and flowing the water. And so as we start to create a reconnection through small-scale water retention projects, which is here's a little trail in our community forest, and we go during the rain and watch water move and then dig a, you know, just a 10-foot wide contour swale, and it holds the water and absorbs it. And 3 months later, we've transformed that soil and are accelerating tree growth. So in a human scale, people are experiencing what happens to hold the water in the land. So this kind of difference of changing the relationship through embodied experience is a really foundational piece of how we do this regenerative work of our imaginations through our felt experiences.
Yeah, I think that's really beautiful. And you're actually starting to answer the questions that Aaron and Alf dropped in the chat. Alf's question was about the lack of elders in communities. And Aaron's question was about the lack of tradition and, you know, people who are floating around without a story. So maybe Aaron and Alf could be unmuted so they could elaborate on those questions, and then we can take it from there.
Yeah, my question is, maybe that's my personal feeling, but I would like to live a different life, but there is this, maybe it's a fear that is unnecessary, but I have that, and it's that going away from what I know, and going away from all that is not separating me from society. Like, it is a very lonely road. And yeah, my question is, if you think that we need to prepare us for that floating without story, or is there a switching path and then it's good because it doesn't feel like it?
And then adding on to Aaron, very similar to designing new stories or rites of passages that bring us together, since we've kind of obviously lost that in modernity. That's a trickle down of a lot of our systemic problems. So mine's more in the design phase of the communities. Like, how do you guys foresee a strategy to design communitas, or allowing it to emerge, to facilitate everything that needs to be done?
I mean, I guess I want to just start with the question of what is home? And the way in which that question is then changed when you say, what's home in a world full of transformations? Because we, there are really rapid transformations everywhere now. And so for me, this question, Aaron, that you're asking around story, this is a question that I think it's easy to get a mono story and to think we have to revisit the narrative. We have to create a new story for Aaron to live in and Nora to live in. And our story is going to look like this, and it's going to be sustainable, and it's going to be ecological, and it's going to have another kind of economy, and it's going to... But that whenever I think about that story in that way, I get this kind of haunted stomach ache of why does it feel so flat? Where are the depths of the detail? Where are the kind of unpredictable ways in which one thing leads to the next thing, leads to the next thing? I mean, just to think about, as you look around the space that you're in right now, how did you get there? And that getting there was an unbelievable collection of nonlinear processes that go every which way. And so I think the first thing is just, I have a kind of a red flag that goes up when it comes time to design that, because I feel like, wait a second. Thank goodness I did not actually design my life 10 years ago, or the plan that I'd be living in right now wouldn't be nearly as interesting as the one that happened. So this kind of process of articulating a future is kind of, it's great for getting going, but it's not so great for actually delivering. Along the way, a million things need to happen, and you need to get, you know, you need to get your heart broken, and you need to get, you know, your path rewritten and your identity reformed, and it's got the stories that emerge will be all over the place. So that's part of it. But then the other thing that I was actually just writing about this yesterday, that there's this really interesting thing about these stories. And the thing about stories is that very often the kind of stories that we're talking about here, which become sort of societal narratives, cultural narratives, that they... Instead of thinking of them as the thing, okay, what happens when you start to think of a narrative as a response to an unanswerable question? Okay, if the question is, who am I? If the question is, why are we here? If the question is, what comes after death? If the question is, what's the meaning of life? Right, those questions are all open-ended questions through which we get these societal narratives that weave all sorts of ways through it, right? And then it's, I think it's some kind of mistake to get caught in thinking we have the wrong narrative. And what I would actually suggest is moving that kind of to the level of, what's the question? And how are these stories telling themselves into these unanswerable questions? Because that way they capture us in another way. You know, when we're reading stories as kids and they have a moral and they have a single moral, and you're like, yeah, 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 you know, the butter melted in his pocket on the way home. I get it. Right? That there's something about the singularity of those kind of moralistic or the lack of depth of context, and just life stuff. You know, a great sci-fi story is full of life stuff, and so I think that's really an important piece of this, that it's the richness and the beauty of how something comes to be is part of the ecology of its being.
Yeah, and I would like to add on to that something that has become a noticeable pattern of need within the Earth Regenerators community that emerged around my book. Because I've now gotten to see just a larger diversity of people having a similar experience. So I can recognize there's some kind of a chronic need. And the chronic need has to do with what I've been calling cultural scaffolding in the context of those conversations, which is that there's some kind of a developmental process as you are becoming you in any moment. So as you're becoming, like if I'm becoming a mathematician by taking math classes at a university, I'm in a scaffolded environment, which is the curriculum of the program. And I have role models and ideals and potential jobs and areas of scholarly research to build upon and so on. And what is interesting is that a lot of the cultural scaffolding that's brought about our planetary collapse also leads to dead ends, which means if you continue in that scaffolding, you don't go to the future that you know you need to go to. And then if you try to step away from that scaffolding, you start to experience the discomfort of not having clear social supports. And your clear social supports are things like, well, if I don't major in this, what do I major in if I'm a university student? Except it's even more fundamental than that. It's it gets to these deep questions of who am I and how do I find meaning in my life? And I was thinking a moment ago as I was listening to Nora of an example in my life that I find, for me, it actually makes me laugh. Because as a kid, I was the awkward kid that got bullied and picked on, but I was also the nerd. And so the one thing that I was valued for was always knowing how to find the right answer in school. And so I came to value myself for being the one who was smart and knew the answers, because that was reinforced in that environment. And I grew up on a farm, really having a sort of condescension against the farm, even though I like manual labor, I like physical work. But feeling like, well, there's something special about me because I'm going to go to university and I'm going to be smart. And I find this funny now, because the most meaningful thing I do in this moment in my life is when it starts to rain, I grab a pickaxe, go out in the rain with a flashlight, and dig holes. And the reason is because I understand ecologically what happens when I do that. And so I'm doing manual labor. I'm basically a hole digger. So if you say, Joe, what is your identity? What is the thing that gives you meaning and purpose? I could say, I'm a regenerative design practitioner, but really what it means is I dig holes in the rain. And so there's this powerful way that I have a surprisingly simple story in my actions. And it's because I've built up in my body a set of motivational reinforcers that actually get me to go out into the rain, that actually get me to do something a little uncomfortable, because I know that it's creating something meaningful, even though the action is small, and I can see the cumulative effects. And so I think part of this question of how do we answer the question of, you know, what story do I live into, is about how do we find meaning in simple actions that help us to be comfortable with either the answer to the identity question being a good joke. Like, isn't it a good joke that Joe's just a hole digger? You know, which is basically taking the ego's need to be important and sort of defusing it. But also that it's often surprising. A year ago, if you'd asked me, what is the most important thing you're doing? I would have given some abstracted narrative about something that had nothing to do with pickaxes and digging holes. And so it's really interesting how being open to discover through your interactions in the world, you discover what's meaningful by being open to exploring and being open to, as Nora said, to finding the questions. So to me, the interesting question about the hole digging is, why is it meaningful to dig holes in the rain? And I have a pretty complex understanding of my environment and why I'm doing it. So I actually have a PhD level understanding of that hole. But if I didn't go out and dig the hole, nothing would happen because no one else is digging the holes. So right now I'm the crazy gringo in Bodhichara running around in the rain with a pickaxe. And so there's something really beautiful about being open to not knowing and then having a joyful surprise at the answers to our questions about the stories we live, which I think is really important in these times of significant change.
I have a question. Both of us are living in cultures that are not the cultures that we grew up in. And I guess my question is, being that we are also both working with an attention and sensitivity to very local complexities and particular patterns. I mean, down to the soil and the, you know, the articulation of various relational processes. But we're not where we came from. And I just want to kind of like open that up. And you know, what do you think about that, Joe? How does that increase your sensitivity, or you know, maybe it decreases it? How is that for you?
That's a beautiful question, because one of my big struggles, especially in adolescence, and it haunted me for a long period of my developmental, you know, kind of childhood development to adulthood, is this feeling of not belonging and this feeling of being unwanted, which took various forms at different times. And then having a sense of needing to be wanted and needing to be from somewhere, to needing to be valued and to be included. And that actually carried me through a long period of time of not having my needs met. So I could have that deferred gratification sort of pattern of continuing to do something that was difficult and not rewarding in its moments. I mean, there were aspects that were rewarding, but overall, I would say it was an extended period of failure, and or failure with respect to what I was trying to achieve as I understood it in the moments that I was in. And so what I feel like is that that has gradually made me capable of getting rid of my arrogance, which was a defensive mechanism for a long time when I was young. I was very angry and arrogant, had a chip on my shoulder, especially when I was like 14 or 15. It was like a period of time where it was more pronounced. And what I've come to gradually is a compassionate place of feeling like I'm always in unfamiliar environments, but recognizing familiar patterns. And then getting to be where the patterns are my friends and the people are sort of like the props of the theatrical performance. And then eventually that became a place of, well, this is a real community and these are real friends. And so where I was not able to be emotionally connected to it for an extended period of time. And so I feel like that felt separation and the need to be a pattern, like a sense maker of patterns. You know, growing up in Southwest Missouri and on a chicken farm where my mom had a collection of books, but none of my friends had books on their shelves. So we were the only literate family. Being the first in my family to go to college, and then hearing my mother's story that for patriarchal sexist reasons, even though she was a national merit finalist, she wasn't allowed to go to college by her father. And, you know, feeling these patterns and rhythms of stories that would be mapped on and motivate me at different times in my life. So I feel like this going into the unknown or the unfamiliar is absolutely essential in doing regenerative work, because the unknown is the other living presences that we collaborate with. So as I collaborate with water, I'm collaborating with microorganisms that I don't see. So there are these unknown others, and I have to be sensitive to them, or else I don't see them respond. And then I don't see what dance I'm in. And so I feel like it's a fundamental piece of the work that I do.
Yeah, I really totally agree with that. I find that it's every day I don't really know where I am or what's going to happen or what people are actually talking about or, you know, where this thing came from or what it means that this leaf is turning or that leaf is not. And in a way, I feel kind of you know, like I read Sand Talk or the words of the indigenous peoples, and I feel so lost from that, that there's this sense of deep belonging that I just don't have. And on the other hand, I also am recognizing that my work is about something different. My work is about how we get out of the kind of traps of perception that the last several hundred, maybe thousands of years have produced, so that we can start to perceive and live in new ways. And that means that that lostness, that that disorientation that I feel every day in Sweden is absolutely critical to the possibility of seeing the edges of my blind spots, of the things that I thought were going to happen don't happen. And every time that that occurs, it's a little reminder, oh, you were riding down a groove and you thought you knew where this was going, but it didn't go there because that was not real. That was just your patterns playing out. That was the script you thought you were in. And so there's this kind of constant bell, you know, that's like ringing on the side of my matrix saying, whoops, you did it again. And I feel like every time I have those moments, it's a gift to, like you said, to the humility, recognizing that that everything that we are needing to do right now actually requires admitting that, you know, we're talking about imagination, but some of this stuff we can't imagine because we have no material to imagine it from that we're conscious of.
Yeah.
That's it, down in the unconscious, I think there's all kinds of material. But being in the conscious verbal daytime world, and getting these kind of wake-up calls is really, really valuable. And it's lonely and disorienting. But what does it mean, actually? What we're talking about when we talk about living in a new way is actually living in new cultures, new patterns that we have never been in before. That we're strangers in our own futures.
Yeah, this is something that
you're a foreigner in your own tomorrow, you know? And so that
yeah, this is really important. We need to live into stories, and those stories emerge by living into them. And so we don't know what they are yet. That's something that I think is of fundamental importance in learn to be comfortable in that unknowing. And what's beautiful is as we get practiced, as we practice doing it, because it's more of a practice than the thinking, that it actually becomes joyful. Mm. And a great training ground for me was our daughter when she was 2, because our daughter is almost 4 now. When our daughter was in her second year, I was unable to finish the sentence when talking to another person because she would interrupt it. And I, at that time, I didn't know how to interrupt my thoughts and pick them up again with that frequency. And she just was like, you know, the Buddhist master hitting me on the hand saying, pay attention, be present, because I was in such a habit of not being present and also not knowing that I was not being present. And, you know, and a toddler is fantastic and teaching this kind of Buddhism, that now I feel quite comfortable getting caught up into a thought process and then getting jumped out of it and then recognizing I was in a thought process. Our daughter's going to get old enough that we're going to lose those reinforcers from her, and we'll see if I still have this skill later. She's good at keeping me in practice these days.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, I'd love to answer that question too. I think both of us, Mike and I, well, I don't know, we've been foreigners in the places that we've lived in for a long time. I grew up in Russia, in, well, back then it was Soviet Union, and I moved to Canada when I was 16, and everything was alien and foreign from then on. I haven't known a place that was home where I belonged since then. And it's actually been a huge blessing in a way, because it's made me question what is real and where my assumptions are, and made me question the things that I was taking for granted before. And the things that I thought were just as it is, and then realizing that they were actually kind of rare or created by people. I'll give you an example. So when I was little, I used to go and visit my grandmother, who lived in Bulgaria in a tiny village in the mountains. And I always felt such a sense of warmth and being welcome and just being taken care of and being able to relax, really relax, in that village that I never felt where I was growing up, because my parents put a lot of pressure on me. You know, I was the gifted child, and I had to get good grades in school, and I had to do a million extracurricular activities, and there was just like go, 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 go all the time. And so in Bulgaria, it was the only place that I could actually just take a breath and, you know, go sit on a mountain and just listen to the birds for hours. And I had this idea that, well, this is just that kind of place. And then my grandmother passed away, and we came back to that house with my family, and there was just like this giant hole, you know? It's like, wow, it wasn't so much the place, it was her. It was all the things that she was doing that were invisible, because you know, we walk into a house and it smells like fresh baked bread, and there's blankets ready for us, and there's fire in this ancient stove. And but it was all her cultivating this space to be welcoming. And I, that it was such a profound thing, because a place is not just a place. It's cultivated by the beings that live there, by the people and the plants and the animals and like the whole ecosystem of all these different relationships and interactions. So I think that a lot of people really take that for granted. And I recently read the book Braiding Sweetgrass by Robin Wall Kimmerer, which is a very, very beautiful book about indigenous wisdom and indigenous ways of knowing and thinking about things. And, you know, she is from a mixed background, and she, I think has a PhD. She went through the, you know, the conventional schooling and university. And so she kind of contrasts those two perspectives of the Western ways of knowing and, you know, very right answers and expertise and confined stuff, and then the indigenous ways of knowing, which are a lot more relational and a lot more about listening to what is actually happening now, not your ideas about what's happening. And she, one of the things she brings up in the book that was very profound for me is the story, the indigenous story of the Sky Woman, which is one of their foundational stories, myths about how the world was formed. And she contrasts it with the Western, with the Christian story of Adam and Eve. So I'll tell you in brief the story of Sky Woman. So Sky Woman is the first woman, and she falls from the sky down and into the water, because there's no earth yet. And she falls into the water, and all the animals come and check her out. I'm like, what is this creature? And then, you know, she asks for dirt or a place to stand, but there is none. So all the animals take turns diving down into the bottom of the sea to look for ground. And none of them succeed. And finally, the little muskrat, which is the weakest of the swimmers, takes an attempt and goes down. And he's gone for a really long time. And the bubbles come up on the surface of the water. And everybody thinks, oh, he's gone. And then finally, little muskrat's body, lifeless body, emerges at the surface of the water. And they notice that he has his fist clenched. And in his fist, there's a little bit of dirt from the bottom of the sea. And then, so the muskrat sacrificed his life for this woman who was a stranger that, you know, tumbled to their land or tumbled to their place. And so they take this dirt and the turtle offers that they rub it on his back. And so as they rub it on his back, it forms land, Turtle Island. And then it turns out that the woman, when she fell from the sky, on her way down, she grabbed seeds and sticks from the Tree of Life. And so she was still holding those seeds and sticks in her hands. And she planted them on the turtle's back and grew all kinds of plants and trees and, you know, a garden emerged. And then, so she invited all the animals to come and live there with her. And together they cultivated this beautiful garden that produced food and safety and habitat for everybody to live. And so this is the story of Sky Woman in a nutshell. She's a foreigner. She's an immigrant. But she comes to a place, and with the help of the beings that live there, she makes it a home for everyone and a garden that provides food and shelter and community. So, you know, contrast this with the story of Adam and Eve, who don't listen to God's instructions and, you know, are then cast out of the Garden of Eden, where everything is abundant, and then they have to work and break their backs for the rest of their lives and all of the generations that come after, just to, you know, to provide for themselves. And there's always this feeling that they're not even in that place. They're not even meant to be in the place that they are, because there's a better place waiting for them in heaven. So there's no reason for them to be stewards of the earth or cultivate it or, you know, make it a habitable place for all the beings that are here, because the next place is waiting for them. So that was such a profound thing for me to hear her contrast these two stories. And I realized, oh my God, you know, what if all of us lived with the story of Sky Woman, who is not from a place, who doesn't have any connection there, but she wants to cultivate it and be a steward of it and be responsible for it and make it a fertile, habitable place for everyone. So, you know, to me, being a stranger is not a bad thing, because it can produce gratitude and it can make you question your assumptions. Mm-hmm. And it can itself be a regenerative force.
It's interesting, because I'm not sure how you do it without that. I mean, I that's why I've kind of brought it in tonight, because I'm not sure if, you know, we're tossing around words about, you know, living in new ways and having new patterns and regenerating and a lot of newness, because it's a way of admitting that so much of the old patterns that we have been within are destructive to each other and to the world that we live in. So I think it's a really important piece to consider deeply around what this relationship is between familiarity and learning. And I don't bring it up lightly, because I think this question extends also into language and what kind of language is being used to explore what it is that collectively, you know, we're here in this Zoom call. What are we doing here? So there's something that we're up to that has to do with these things, and these words come in, and they're words that have histories. They're words that already have played into various patterns and processes. And yet we're trying to use these words to describe something that we've actually never, a future we've never been to before. So it's a really interesting problem. And sometimes I feel a great deal of frustration around it because, it takes decades to find terminology, to coin words, to do the research, to bring them in, you know, words like systems, words like complexity. And then we have words like system change, and we have words like, there's lots of them that are being tossed around right now. And it doesn't happen, but in 1 second that they get kind of metabolized and digested into the existing system. And so that thing you're talking about when you start talking about complexity turns out to be, you know, a kind of seminar process that has something to do with a whole lot of post-its. And, you know, there's like this thing, it gets co-opted. And then what are we talking about? So I think this question of how to talk about things so that they're familiar enough that we can understand them, but unfamiliar enough that we don't fall asleep, that we're constantly kind of feeling that disorientation and learning, to be in not the comfort of having learned and owning that new information, but constantly, you know, refinding the edges. I'm curious about that because I you open your social media or LinkedIn or whatever it is, and people are talking about, the language is being used in ways that are already so grooved in and scripted. And there are times, you know, when we think, oh, what we need to do is we need to turn this regenerative concept into a meme. And if the meme would go viral, we could really get somewhere. Right? But if the meme goes viral, it's gone. Like, that's the last thing we want. You know, you were talking about the work is invisible. I talk about warm data. It's happening underground. It's underground. It's like the underground railroad. It's like the soil. It's what's happening in the dirt. It's not visible. The stuff that's changing, the stuff where the work is, you can't see it. And so much of our culture just wants to, you know, make it explicit, be direct. Tell me what you're going to say before you say it, and then say it. And then tell me what you said. Remember? That's how we learn to write papers. But somewhere under all of that, there's this other thing that I think is both beautiful and vital.
Related to the question of the travel and what it's like to be a foreigner, there's something that keeps coming up for me that relates to the story that Yuvi told and that Joe has told about relating to how we sit with complexity and ambiguity. There's something that comes up for me with the travel that relates to the necessity for courage. I just can't... I think that's it. I see what's happening on the news, like headlines like, should we start to be afraid? Or should we be afraid right now? And I see courage as being the only answer and is the main answer for me in being a foreigner in another country. It's like stepping from propositional knowing to participatory knowing is scary and unknown and sometimes dangerous. And it only requires a step. And that step only requires courage. And everything since has just required that practiced first step. What is, to you two, the importance of courage?
I think about courage in this sense as being something Nora was saying about how we need to sense into things that we don't name, and that actually we should not try to name them because it stops an inquiry process that is enabling us to know. Like, we come to know things as a process. We are learning things as an openness, and there's a closedness that comes when we stop doing that. And an example that I have is an interesting topic of how do you measure success. And one of the things that has been coming up for me is how to observe some health indicators without knowing what they are ahead of time. So that when I perceive one, it is one. I didn't already have it in mind and then go find it. And my example of this from this year is I've been visiting an aquifer system, which is this ridge line above our town. So the example I was giving was that as I visited different pieces of land in the aquifer system, I started to see well springs that have all dried up. And so now I know that a measure of systemic health is that water flows from those well springs again. This is related to the courage question, which is the ability to not know and to be comfortable not knowing and still take exploratory action. It's just taking actions to come to know. So I wouldn't have known ahead of time. I should be looking at well springs. Although if someone told me that, I would have said, oh yeah, that makes sense. But this became an observed measure because the courage was the ability to go and visit a piece of land without really knowing why I was doing it. So someone said, there are these people who are interested in possibly doing reforestation. Let's go visit them. And everyone else is saying, these are the rich people from this area that cut down all the trees and build hotels. These are the bad guys. And I'm like, I'm not going to accept that judgment. I just want to go see what they have to say. And what I actually care about is listening to the land even more than listening to the people. And then I discovered that it was the wellsprings. I need to be looking at where the water comes out of the ground to see how to measure health. I didn't go there knowing that I was looking for a measure of systemic health. I just knew that if I didn't go there, I would be talking about land from a Google satellite map instead of from walking the land. And so I knew to walk the land instead. And this is related to courage, because I'm talking to people I don't know who may have ulterior agendas, who might undermine or corrupt what I'm doing, all kinds of things people might say if I talk to them about being strategic. But by being open and knowing I needed to walk the land, I basically don't know anything until I walk the land, was how I was able to come to know this. So I think there's a really important thing of taking action in a mindset of learning and practicing it until it's habitual.
Yeah, the reason for that question was really about addressing that need for certainty and
comfort.
Yeah, and comfort, but also to have things figured out before you attempt to do things. Like, I feel like that's the big hindrance to participatory knowing and effective action, is having embodied experience in the thing. And it's just a lot more comfortable to write out a map and then attempt to give it to someone else, the government or some group, go solve this problem now. It's a lot harder to not have a map and step into complexity, not knowing the answer, and then learn from in a reciprocal way from the environment. And it just keeps coming back. The travel question was what hit home for me, because that's exactly what we did in 2012 when we bought a one-way ticket and left our country and didn't come back for nearly a decade. Every single thing, every single step along that way to collect embodied experiences was a step that required courage, because it was scary every single time.
I mean, I think when I think about courage, just to add to what you guys are saying, because I think so much has been kind of said already, but there's something about hope. So there's a kind of way in which I kind of shy away from talking about hope sometimes, because it can get very blinded. You know, there's a way in which if you're talking about hope, it's like you're not really able to deal with the rigor of how serious everything is, because you keep trying to make it hopeful. But this could happen, or but that could happen, or everything's going to be okay. And it's like, you know, actually, everything's going to be really, really a mess for a while. And life is going to continue, and we'll see what happens. And so for me, this question of courage, because I was thinking to myself, like, when are the moments in my life when I've really had courage? And I think both of you articulated beautiful examples of that. And I think for me, the moments when I had to do something that I was totally unprepared for consciously, that I stepped into some kind of way of being that I didn't know I had. There was some something that came from something else, somewhere else in me than I thought I had to draw from. There was a resource that I didn't know that I could find. And that thing we call courage might have been in that particular well that I had no idea was there. But then there's this other thing, which is when I have consciously gone into situations that I knew somehow I was going to need to be more than I thought I was to be there. And this is an interesting question to me. Like, where in you do you find that thing? Where is it? How do you nourish that place? And maybe we could call it morale. That there's a sort of sense of not, you know, hope at the level of everything's going to be okay, but this other thing, which is, here we go. Here we go. And I don't know what the hell's going to happen, but I'm rolling up my sleeves and I've got my big girl pants on and here we go. And there's something in that that there's substance, some substance, internal substance to draw from there. And where does it come from? How do you help or contribute to the production of that morale in not only yourself, but in the relationships that you're in? Because I think this is probably one of the more important possibility producers of how community relationships are produced, how relationships to change, how we go through. I mean, you know, we've been through the last 8 months and goodness knows what the next 8 months are bringing. So I think that this question of morale is the difference between, you know, the feeling that I'm just not enough. I just can't do it. I just can't. So for me, that's kind of what courage is in a different kind of way. I mean, I obviously the word comes from heart, and there's something about having heart, having the heart to do it. And I think that you don't get that maybe by yourself. It's something that's produced in relationship.
Yeah, I would love to hear. Phoebe asked a really good question in the chat. And Phoebe, I'd love it if you would speak to your question for a moment. I have some thoughts about the question, but I'd love to hear your thoughts first, because I think you've touched on something really important.
Sure. Hi. I would just pre-text the question that I think it's something, Nora, you and I have spoken about, and Nora, you've spoken about safety, which came to mind as you were talking about courage, which was this sense of like, when I was listening to UV, when you were talking about leaving the place you were familiar with and going out on a big adventure, and I was just thinking, how do we frame courage when the things that used to feel safe don't feel safe anymore? And I'm, you know, I've grappled with that throughout my life with like a, you know, a path set out for me in academia and, you know, like a kind of looking at the future and what should I do and all of this kind of thing. And it's like that's the thing that used to be safe and now it doesn't feel safe. And so then it's courageous to do all this, you know, to set out on a very alternative path and, you know, try and work it out yourself. But then also, I mean, in a way it would be courageous to stay in academia, you know, it would be courageous to stay on the ship that's sinking, or do you know what I mean? So it kind of it reframes courage. And I, yeah, love to hear you guys chat about that.
Yeah, that was something I felt drawn to speak to, because a lot of people said when we went to Costa Rica to live in a tropical rainforest off grid almost 2 years ago now, and everyone at the time said, wow, you're so brave to do that with your small child. And at the time I was thinking, but I'm in the United States, where I see the continual progression of increasing amounts of fascism and other deeply problematic things. I'm actually going to a place of safety. I'm actually going away from danger because I perceive and understand it. And so I found this way of feeling exactly what you're talking about, which is that by understanding a systemic pattern, you know, when we do understand one, we can see threats more accurately. We discern better. And I think there are a lot of ways that normalcy or continuing to do what is familiar is treated as though that's safe. But that's only true in an environment that's not changing. In an unchanging environment, what used to work probably still works. But in a changing environment, in a sense, not all bets are off, but most bets are off. You don't actually know what's going to work. So doing the same thing is actually fairly foolish. Mm. And so there's a really powerful way of recognizing that. You know, courage in my mind here is not the right frame for distinguishing this. And just using it as a prompt to jump off to, I see this as more, do I act on how I know the world to be, or do I not? So if I come to a place where I realize that the habitual way of doing things is actually dangerous, do I keep doing it or do I change? And then in a sense, this is more like being foolish or not, or something like that. Which is, do I manage the risks as I increasingly understand them? Because there might be very good reason to keep doing the old thing. Like, I might stay in the United States because my mother is sick and I'm going to care for her until she dies. Then I at least know that I'm making the decision for a reason that I care about. But to say that it's brave or not brave to make a change, there's this ability to discern is so fundamental to that in a changing environment. And I think when the frames are treated in a static way, like are you courageous or not, is a static framing, which is not, I know that's not what Mike meant, but I'm just drawing it for a juxtaposition. So what we're really talking about is whether we're being intelligent or not. Where here intelligence means, are we having integrity in our decisions by taking in information that supports our decisions? Which is, are we open to updating our mental models? And so if I update my mental models, for example, when I studied climate science 15 years ago, I updated my mental models. I was like, well, shit, I need to be in a place that has a more stable climate, or I have to be in a place that has more resilient community, because climate is changing. And so I updated my mental model from a static background of climate to a dynamic background of climate. And then bravery and foolishness have very different meanings from one frame to the other.
There's, you know, Phoebe brought up something interesting that created a distinction in my mind of the types of fear. There's that fear when you know there's something you want to do or need to do that is like an obstacle, or it could just be the perception of an obstacle that's just an illusion and you have to take the first step and go. But then there's that sneaky fear where the assumptions you had about the world no longer apply, or they're breaking down, and suddenly that thing comes in the back door and you're like, oh shit, all my assumptions are wrong right now. What do I do? And that's the one that I feel is hardest to do something about, because it does require that degree of letting go of attachment to what you thought you wanted and what you needed, and reframing and having discernment and looking at what is, and then coming up with a plan or coming up with the next thing that you, you know, to turn it into the first kind of fear where it's just simply another step. But yeah, that distinction I find is really useful. Actually, it's the first time that's occurred to me that it's that sneaky fear that's really the challenge.
I think there's something about safety too that I know that, you know, working with some of the communities that I work with that are, they're not safe. They're not safe. And probably the least comforting thing you can do in those communities is to come in and act as though everything's going to be okay. Yeah. And to come in and say, you know, things like we want to create a safe environment for you to express your feelings. Right? And ironically, what that actually reads at as a, in a community that's really in danger is this is not safe. If somebody comes in and says, we're going to really listen to you and we're going to give you the respect that you deserve, that's kind of code for no one's listening to you and we have to go way out of our way to give you that respect. So if you have to talk about it, it probably isn't there. Which is, you know, it's kind of counterintuitive because you'd think it would be something reassuring. But what is safe in those places is actually to be able to deal with the complexity of what's going on and not to trivialize or to compartmentalize or to in any way reduce their struggle and their pain into a particular experience. You know, I know, you know, poverty, but you know, poverty's not about money. Poverty is about education. It's about culture. It's about family. It's about home. It's about home. Right? And if you come in with some poverty plan, it's like, it's not soothing. This is not going to make people feel safe. And so I think there's, you know, I really loved what you said there, Joe, because it's the things, you know, we aren't living in a safe world. This isn't a safe time. And not only is it not safe economically or ecologically, you know, it's not as though climate change is going to happen to a lot of otherwise perfectly sane and stable people. Right? What the world that we're moving into is a world in which people are carrying, they're carrying pain, they're carrying lostness, they're carrying confusion, and they're generating it between each other. When we first started this call tonight, it's like, how are you? Well, you know, watching the way people who are confused get irritated with each other and how sensitive people are feeling and the strange ways in which people are interacting with each other right now. And saying, look, this is not abnormal. This is how it is. when the world is changing around you, you are not who you used to be. And so that's not safe. So somehow part of what makes it safe is the ability to say, it's not safe. And then it can start to be safe. Then we can say, okay, at least nobody's, you know, trying to sell us some, you know, Rolex here. At least this is, at least we're on the level. Which is not to you know, wave a big flag of fear and doom and gloom and apocalypse, and but it is to just be, okay, this is what it is, and here we go. And that, I think, is a really important part of complexity. And to my experience, the people who are actually most in danger are the most ready to do the complexity, because they know that the danger that they're in wasn't produced from one causation. People who live comfortably have the illusion that their comfort was derived through linear means in a structured system that's actually working. And yeah. The hardest people to do systems work with are actually the ones who are the most comfortable.
This is exactly my experience too, where I'm in a place where we have water scarcity. Didn't have any water in our house for a day and a half that ended this morning. And a lot of people would say, well, why would you move with your small child to a place where you may not have water in your house? And I actually feel safer here than I did living in Seattle, where we had to rent a house that cost $3,000 a month. And we had to have several roommates to share the house with because we couldn't afford it. And there were a large number of variables that we depended upon for our survival, but that were actually largely dictated by other people's incentive structures. Here, at least, we have a water tank on our roof that when it rains, it collects water, and it's here. It's at our house. So if we have water scarcity, it's because we didn't do the work of catching water when the water comes. So it's this complacency of trusting institutions to take care of us actually makes us domesticated. And what we need to be is we need to be, the Spanish word is silvestre, which is the word for being wild. We have a silvestre child. Our daughter, everyone loves how she's running around without her shoes on, climbing trees, holding millipedes on her hand, completely comfortable, trying to catch and rescue the cockroaches because she thinks they're sweet. You know, like, and she's very comfortable in this space because we give her so much time in nature. And you can see how what other people would think of that as unfamiliar, dirty, possibly dangerous, it might bite you. What we're actually doing is learning how to be in relationship, reciprocal relationship with the survival needs of our environment, which actually the very powerful thing that generates from a human mind is adaptive cognition, which is it allows us to pay attention to what we need to do different when the situation changes. So that day and a half when we didn't have water, we found a way to get by just fine. We were okay. If I told my friends from the US we didn't have water in our house, because there's water scarcity, and I say, oh my God, are you okay? We're like, no, we're cool. We roll with this stuff all the time. Because we put ourselves in an environment where we're practicing active improvisation. Mm-hmm. And that's actually why we're safe. We're safe because we're not complacent. But we're also not anxious. We're pretty relaxed. This is a low-key little town. And so it's like really chill. I work less than I used to work, and I'm more productive. And so there's something really profound about not being complacent because you're actively co-creating, but actively co-creating doesn't mean it's always effortful. Actively co-creating just means being open to adapt by being aware when things change. And we're doing this like 24/7, and actually it's awesome. It's like dancing, it's fun. I mean, there are moments that aren't fun, but the majority of it is actually fun. And so so I think there's something really powerful about this embodied practice of openly co-creating with our environments. It's absolutely beautiful when we live this way.
Yeah, I really totally agree with that. This business of being able to be in constant improvisation. I lived in Asia for a while, and I don't know if you've ever driven in Asia, but to drive in Asia is another example of this, because there's really not a lot of rules. I was in Thailand, and I was going to school up in the north up there, and so there was all sorts of things in the road, and so you have to pay attention. It's a kind of attention, and you're just never not in attention, and so you don't fall into the kind of half numb monotonies. That then when those grooves that were holding the structures that were holding you in place are gone, it's like, freak out. No, you're never in that groove. So when something isn't there, you're already moving with it. And so I really, that is the thing. Somebody asked earlier, what does it look like to live in parallel? And that's a big part of it, is that readiness to maneuver into different ways to solve whatever comes up. And, there's this word in English that has to do with cobbing. Right? You can say that you cobbed something together, which means you used a little of this and a little of that and a little of this, and you kind of figured it out and you made it work. And it's that thing that is not just an art form, it's a way of life, of thinking, of being.
Yeah, this relates beautifully to being bioregional, which is the big topic of how to live in a place. And I particularly like Peter Berg's writings on this, but there are a lot of great thinkers. And one of the pieces is to be the expression of the landscape. And I had a phrase that I used once in a conversation earlier this year where I said, we're just animated dust, which of course is an old metaphor from Judaism, ashes to ashes, dust to dust. But being animated dust in a bioregional sense is we are actually the land living out a life. And when we invert it, instead of saying, how do I as a living being survive in this land? And instead say, how does this land create living beings like me? Then we're being bioregional, because I am breathing the air that moves through this land. I'm drinking the water that moves across this land. I'm pooping out the nutrients back into this land, right? Like, I am the land animated. And when I start from that point of view of the land, which me as a dynamic flow within it, then I can understand a sustainable life, because it's congruent with the land from that frame. But if I start as me as separate from the land and try to construct a sustainable life, I'm very likely to miss something. And so these frame shifts are super interesting, not just intellectually, but how we live them. Like how we did the dance of where did we get our water for that day? Was we were animated dust. We were living beings living in the land as things were changing in the land. In this case, the land didn't bring water to our house. So it's very interesting to be in that dynamism.
Guys, I've really, really enjoyed this conversation, and I hate to have to bring it to a close here, but thank you everyone for participating. Thank you, Nora and Joe. This has been awesome. Been smiling the whole time.
Yeah, it's been amazing. It's been one of my favorites for a while.
No, Nora, I always feel like you and I dance well together. I love it.
Thanks, Joe, and thanks, Mike and Yubi, and thanks everybody. It's been really actually the conversation was a good example of everything we were saying, because we didn't know where it was going to go, or what sort of relationships we were going to be building along the way. So I love it when it becomes the form becomes an expression of the actual content.
Yeah, and Mike and Yuvi, just to say again how I'm so thrilled to see your journey from when we spoke back in April to where you are now in your progress in British Columbia. It's just beautiful to see you living it. Really, really loving it.
Thank you. Yeah.
Thank you. I feel like we're just starting.
It's going to feel that way for another 20 or 30 years.
Actually, it's probably always going to feel that way.
Yeah. Yep, exactly.
With any luck.
If it goes well, it's going to feel wonderfully creative all the time, or the majority of the time.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Hope you guys will visit sometime.
Ooh, I miss it. I bike forward to that area. Love it. So thank you for hosting us today and gathering.
Thank you. See you guys.
Thank you. And thank you for coming, everyone.
Now, bye, everyone.
Bye.
If you like this content, you might want to check out our 7 Ways to Adapt to the Future guidebook. Get it for free at futurethinkers.org/signup. You might also want to check out our Future Thinkers membership area. We have courses there to help you adapt to the changing world, build resilience, upgrade culture and society, and create meaning and purpose in your life. As well, you'll get access to our community, all of our unreleased content, private Zoom calls, live Q&As with guests, workshops and events, and more. Just go to members.futurethinkers.org. And if you enjoyed this video, please like, share, and comment. It really helps out our show more than you know. And if you want more like it, then subscribe and hit that bell icon to be notified of new videos. See you next time.